some lakes I wouldn't go swimming.
Yes, yes. The Environment, Economic Development, and Agriculture Division for Monday, April 7th, 2014 will come to order. It's my understanding that Senator Schmidt is sick and is not here today, so Senator Hoffman's pinch hitting. Normally, I probably would not have allowed the bill to be heard, but since we have some people that have come from distances to come and testify here today, we decided to accommodate the people that are in the audience. So, Senator Hoffman, why don't you go ahead and proceed with what you know about Senate File 2227, and if you need Mr. Meyer to help you, I'll just go ahead and turn it over to him.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I not only Mr. Meyer and also Mr. Knopf, too. I'll have some points, too, as well. But thank you for your opportunity to hear Senate File 2227. It's the Game and Fish Provision Modifications. Senator Schmidt is the chief author of this good bill and is under the weather, as you know, today. And so I'm sitting in as the co-author. I'm going to sit in for him on this bill. So Senate File 2227 has been heard and passed the Fish and Wildlife.
And Senator Hoffman, just so everybody knows, your name isn't on the bill, but it got added on the floor today, correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chair and members. Yes.
Okay.
It's been heard by the Fish and Wildlife Subcommittee, the Environment and Energy, and State and Local Government and Judiciary. So it's been through multiple stops. Much of the bill is proposed by the Department of Natural Resources and deals with game, fish, and natural resources management needs. It attempts to address the trend in declining participation in outdoor recreation and enhance fishing and hunting opportunities. It is also repeals obsolete and redundant statutes. Several provisions were brought into the bill in the Fish and Wildlife Subcommittee. Most of the bill is non-controversial, and all policy in the bill has been thoroughly discussed as it went through four committees. I believe there are two amendments, Mr. Chair. I think there's an A8 amendment by Senator Saxog and an A10 amendment, A10 by Senator Haw.
And
thank you.
I never mess up that name. That's just.
And since this isn't the first committee that this bill's been in, we'll have to have them offer the amendments and explain them. So, Mr. Meyer, do you want to go through the bill so that we can understand what's in it before we start doing amendments?
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you very much for the record. Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources, and Senator Hoffman is correct. This is the DNR annual fish and game bill. There are a number of provisions that did come from the department. There are some things that are technical corrections or deletions that we're removing. Section 1 deletes an antiquated section of statute and a citation dealing with the Flood Control Act of June 28, 1938. You'll see on page 2. Section 2 also repeals a piece of statute that's no longer needed dealing with Loch Lafaro Big Stone County projects. Section 3 is another technical correction change. Section 4 basically takes and applies the ATV statutes to the use of snowmobiles during hunting season. Unfortunately, with the winters that we've been having, the snowmobile use is probably becoming more prevalent during shooting of deer, and this would allow that restriction from sunrise, and then from 11 to 2, you'd be able to use your snowmobile, and after sunset, if you have a snowmobile or a deer hunting license, I should say, Mr. Chairman. Section 6 is a technical correction, just conforming statutes. Section 7 is another consideration for us, just clarifying the use of eminent domain or when it would be used or not used. It says no money shall be used to acquire lands or interest in the department. We're striking that so we can use friendly condemnation if the landowner should desire. Section 8 is another technical correction. Section 9, I believe, comes from Senator Saxog's shooting sports grants bill. There's similar language that's also within the supplemental budget in the Senate as well. Deals with the grant program
so,
there.
Mr. Meyer, are we sure the eminent domain one's not controversial?
Mr. Chairman, we're just declared technical correction.
Doesn't look very technical. Is it technical?
Mr. Chair, on line 4.10, that's a technical change because 84.811 is being repealed in the bill. The remainder of that, no money should be used to require, or the department determines the money will not be required to meet the requisition of counties. I mean, that's actually That's dealing with the former indebtedness of counties. The reason we have these lands in the state is because the counties were underwater, and the state had to bail them out, and the lands became a special kind of tax forfeited land. I don't think that last sentence would be applicable anymore. The eminent domain power is already there. This just eliminates the reference to the statute being repealed, and then eliminates some language dealing with the money for the counties to pay off the ditch bonds.
Okay. Go ahead, Bob. Senator Edesik.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I have a vague recollection. It was a busy week last week. We had this discussion on eminent domain last week, and was it so that you couldn't purchase with Lessard Sams and possibly LCCMR money lands that had been same purchased by eminent domain? So is this a conflict, or how does that
Mr. Knopf
relate?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Edesik. This would be a little. This is different. I mean, that's a prohibition on using an entity who receives a grant or money from the Outdoor Heritage Fund to use it to acquire land by eminent domain. This is an eminent domain provision that exists, that basically existed in law. I think it's about 1929 for the consolidated conservation lands, and it's a special purpose. And I don't think any of the. I can't foresee a time when Outdoor Heritage Fund money would be used for this purpose.
Okay.
Okay, Mr. Mayor.
Mr. Chairman, and I should just also say many of these technical corrections are game of fish related unsession ideas that the department has come up with, and they're in the game of fish wheel because of that familiarity piece. Section 9 we spoke of. Section 10 deals with wild rice provisions and references game of fish laws. It eliminates a provision related to wild rice. Just another technical correction. Section 11 clarifies that the DNR Budget Oversight Committee.
Hold on. You said wild rice. This is technical.
Where is that?
Well, slow down, Mr. Chairman. Section 11. Section 10.
I think it's fine. Let's just slow down.
Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Chair. Yes, I think you could consider this a technical. There is actually history behind why this exists in this place, because originally the wild rice provisions were in the game and fish laws former Senator Miriam recodified those game and fish laws in 1986. It was thought that we had to include this because it was included under the previous law, but it was never subsequently cleaned up. And this is now the subsequent cleanup, quite a few years later.
So this is just taking the reference to wild rice out of the game and fish laws? Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Chair, they do not exist under the game and fish laws, but originally before the game and fish laws were recodified, they were quoted under there, but they were moved to Chapter 84 as part of that recodification. And so this remained to make sure that the law held up to the way it was before. And all this does is tell the ownership of wild animals. And as Mr. Meyer said, wild rice really doesn't quite fit under that. And so this is being removed, but again, it was there because it was there prior to recodification. And the legislature probably should have, but we just didn't do that over the years, come back and clean that up. I think this is an appropriate cleanup of it.
Okay. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, that brings us to Section 11, which deals with the Budget Oversight Committee. The language on top of page 6 just clarifies that they are not governed under 15059 and are not subject to that section. So they do not receive per diem, but we do provide mileage and a meal for them at their annual or their monthly meetings. Section 12 is a clarification relating to game farms, another unsession, just striking the DNR's authority for game farms. Section 13 is adding highway licensed vehicles and motorboats to the list of vehicles that a hunter with a permanent physical disability can use on W or wildlife management areas with a special permit. Section 14 allows this special permit to be used to cross WMA lands for persons without other reasonable access to certain lands. Section 15 actually came to us through a issue with Senator Skoy, a constituent that he had bought a license, and there was no authority for us to provide a refund. So the Section 15 does allow us its authority if the vendor does make a mistake now to provide that refund. Section 16 is related to that as well. Allows the DNR to correct a license when a license was issued incorrectly. Section 17 expands the availability for persons to purchase pictorial wildlife stamps without purchasing the stamp for validation if you're collecting those stamps. Section 18 removes a cross-reference to a section that's repealed in the repealers. Section 19, 20, 21, 22 all deal with the license fee increases from 2012 and the fact that we reduced the price of the Dark House angling license to $5 and made it a requirement to have a fishing license as well. All of these are correcting the lifetime license charges for those licenses that deal with Dark House angling. So you'll see the lifetime sporting license, the sporting with spearing, and other related licenses are changed according to what their actual price is now. There's language later on in the bill that allows us to provide refunds for people who bought those licenses at the wrong price. Section 23 is a technical correction that was also left out dealing with bear hunting. Residents and non-residents 18 or older and 18 or under, you'll see 10.31 for residents. Persons 10, 11, or 12 will be able to take bear without a fee, and 13 to 18 for $5 as part of our recruitment and retention efforts. We do the same thing in Section 24 for non-residents as well. Section 25 deals with a charge. Our 100% disabled licenses, when we did that license fee increase, the language actually placed a dollar service fee on all licenses that are there issued by a vendor. This would repeal that $1 fee to those 100% service disability licenses, which I believe there's an amendment dealing with those licenses in, at the desk, Mr. Chairman.
Excuse me, Mr. Meyer. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Meyer, would you just go back to the kid fee, the $5 fee? Can you tell me what North Dakota and South Dakota do? Do they reciprocate that, or Wisconsin?
Mr. Chairman,
some discussions on that before.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, they don't. Other states do. Nebraska, for example, has a similar program where it's very cheap for youth, non-resident youth to come hunt. We're trying to work with North Dakota and South Dakota and show them our good faith that they should do this as well. So we're hopeful it's a step in the right direction.
Thanks.
Okay, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, that brings us to Section 26, which eliminates the requirement for the DNR to provide standardized forms for road authorities on deer kills. Section 27 just states that we're adding that a person, once you tell a person to get off of your property, they cannot come back for a period of a year without being notified. It's a technical issue where you have to tell somebody every day is what we were seeing.
Mr. Chair, one question.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
With regards to the monitoring of the deer kill here, so are we going to be the DNR is not going to be getting counts on car killed deer? Is that, somebody called me on that the other day.
Mr. Chairman, this would repeal the requirement that the local road authority has to report, so yes, you're correct.
So we're not going to have a count on all these deer kills statewide, and the DNR doesn't find that valuable?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen, the problem we're seeing is that we didn't feel that those numbers were accurately being reported to begin with. So we're going to try to figure out how to work and collect some of that data separately, but this just wasn't working the way we thought that it should.
Thanks.
Mr. Chairman, Section 27, we were just talking about the trespass within 1 year. Section 28 deals with trespassing and knowing violation. With a gross misdemeanor penalty for knowingly trespass on land. Section 29 is a section that we did spend some time discussing within the Judiciary Committee and also in the Policy Committee dealing with discharging of firearms within a stockade or a corral. This has been an issue, Senator, Mr. Chairman, that we've been working with you on. This solves part of the inadvertent problem that was created when we came up with a solution for your constituents several years ago, and that we're seeing people, to keep people hunting on public property, they would develop these stockades or corrals during the hunting season and thereby prohibit a person from hunting on a wildlife management area, for example. We've been working with stakeholders, and you'll see here the changes in law that we're creating. Well, the effective pieces are 15.10 to 15.12. That basically says this paragraph does not apply to a person hunting during an established hunting season on public land. That is not a road right-of-way, and the stakeholders do support that language. We need to come back next year, and the department will be pulling together a stakeholder group, including Farm Union, Farm Bureau, and other interested parties to deal with what is occurring. It's I call it livestock harassment, where a neighbor would be discharging a firearm because they don't like their other neighbor, but and harassing their livestock. So we need to get at the private property piece of this as well, and we'll be working on that. Hopefully, come up with a solution to present to you next session, Mr. Chair.
Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Meyer, that section is similar to, I think, the same time Senator Tomasoni was working on something. I had a constituent in a similar situation. And they have private land next to public ground, and trying to think of the resolution we came up with, but I thought it was a bigger setback or something. Are we affecting that, or can you talk a little bit more about that? Do you remember the situation I'm talking about?
Mr. Chair,
Meyer.
Senator Westrom, I do remember that, and I believe that's actually federal wildlife or waterfowl production area situation,
right,
where your constituents have. This language would allow a person to hunt on that property during the hunting seasons, but I think what was occurring in your situation and also Senator Tomasoni's is that during the non-hunting seasons, people were discharging firearms next to private property borders because it was like a Hatfield-McCoy type situation, right? So,
well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Meyer, my particular constituent issue, I think, was during hunting season, and it was that they would get so close that it would scare the livestock. I'm just hoping we're not repealing that totally. I'd have to go back and look and see what we exactly did about 3 years ago. But are you saying we're repealing all of that from 3 years ago? Or,
Mr. Chairman, Senator Westrom, no, it's still against the law, you'll see, to discharge a firearm within 500 feet of a building occupied by human or livestock. But what we're clarifying is that a person may discharge a firearm within that stockade or corral that's confining livestock during the hunting seasons on public land. So let's work with, okay, let me contact you, work with you and your office and your constituent on that issue and see if this is hopefully not making it worse. But
okay. So the 500 feet, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Meyer, would still be a setback even to discharge that firearm or not during hunting season?
It's not during the hunting season, I believe.
I see. Okay. I do think that could be a problem because I know it was hunting season when they called me, but let's talk about that afterwards.
I'll make sure that we do that, Mr. Senator.
Okay.
Section 30 just clarifies that electronic range finders can be used and a special permit's not needed during the muzzleloader season. Section 31, I believe, came through the committee process allowing crossbows during the bow hunting season for take deer, bear, turkey, or rough fish with crossbow at age 60 or older. Currently, you need a special permit to do that. Section 32 clarifies this electronic range finder, that you can use electronic range finder at night and it's not a violation of the shining law. Section 33 is a
Senator
prohibition.
Mr. Meyer, on that crossbow, if I heard you right, we're allowing anybody over the age of 60 to use crossbows, and I particularly had a constituent contacting me about that issue. Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Westrom, yes, this would allow. Currently, you can use a crossbow for bear during the firearms rifle season for deer and for turkey, but not during the bow hunting season without a special permit. This would allow a person age 60 or over to use a crossbow to take any regulated wild animal that you could use a rifle for.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Section 33 deals with thermal imaging equipment, making it against the law to have thermal imaging equipment, just like it is against the law to have night vision equipment right now. Section 34 and several other sections, sections 35, relate to a recodification in 37 under the small game animals. As part of our on-session activities, we looked at the small game statutes, and they were all kind of put together one by one. What we're doing here is Section 37 allows a commissioner by rule to set open seasons, prescribe limits and restrictions on and designate areas for small game as defined in 97A.015. And then section 34, disturbing and taking from burrows and dens, and 35, prohibited hunting methods of fire, smoke, or cutting trees are pieces that were in that statute that we're recodifying that we needed to place in statute here. Section 38 is a technical correction to the Division of Fish and Wildlife name. Section 39 and 40 are also those technical corrections. Section 41 is a piece that we actually missed in last year's Game and Fish Bill. This is something we were working with Senator Brown on. It allows for persons or their agents on land and on public waters to non-lethally harass Canada geese. Section 42 allows the DNR to establish areas for the taking of migratory game birds. Section 43 deals with invasive species training for minnow and leech harvesters. Section 44 is a requires an invasive species permit certification for commercial fish license holders and their apprentices to have this. Both of these licenses or training will be available online. It takes you about 45 minutes or so. It's similar to what we require dock or water. I can't think of the technical term right now. Boat lifts, docks, swim platforms, things like that that need training, AIS training as well. Section 45, Senator, I believe Senator Tomasoni, is your bill. That is, I think, has already passed all committees. Is on awaiting final passage dealing with deer raffles. And I know the Gambling Control Board does support this language that's in the bill. It also clarifies our ice fishing contests and straightens that out for us as well. Section 46 is a bill that Senator Saxon had dealing with appropriation from 2009. Basically, what we're doing is appropriating $100,000 of these funds to a grant for Itasca County Gun Club, Country Gun Club, for a shooting sports facility relocation and improvements, and the other $200,000 will be used to do firearm safety training activities within the metropolitan area, Seven County metropolitan area. Section 47 does allow us to provide those refunds for the lifetime game and fish license adjustments. Section 48 is related to the small game codification, allowing us to establish gray partridge bag limits. Section 49 came through, I believe this is Senator Hoffman's language, which establishes a 55-inch muskie minimum size length, gives us the authority to establish rulemaking. Section 50 is rulemaking related to the snowmobile during deer hunting changes. Section 51 is Senator Dibble's bill related to narrow leaf cattail control with Lorien Park Lake. We have had several very productive meetings with the Park Board. They do have an existing management permit for this water body that we're working with them on. We'll work with Senator Dibble on the term unrestricted. I don't think that's not needed any further. Quail recovery plan was amended into the bill by Senator Schmidt. Section 53 is a $2 million appropriation from the Game and Fish Fund for the shooting sports facilities grants. And then Section 54 relates to a letter or a request that we received from the manufacturer of the Conibear trap. Actually, in statute, we have the term Conibear trap, and they want us to change that because of trademark infringement, they feel. And then the repealers are all unsession-related, 84145, dealing with the La Caparra Water Control Project, 84A04, county auditor to make lists. This goes back to 1929 on the Concon lands. 84A.08 deals with that Red Lake WMA. 84.11 is related to that piece as well. 97A.081, another posting land repealer. We're getting rid of that requirement. The hunting and fishing on state land, we already have rules on that. Exemption from licensing requirement. For some reason, disabled railroad and postal retirees don't need fishing licenses. And we couldn't find out where that came about or who's even using this exemption any further. So we're repealing that. The next one, 97A, Lifetime Fish and Wildlife Trust Fund report, eliminates a report. Another report in 97B.061 is repealed. The next piece is squirrels, rabbits, raccoons, bobcat, all deal with the small game codification as well as ox fisher, and the game bird section. That all of those sections there on page 4R brings us to on page 5R the Muskellunge Lakes. Actually, we no longer use this process to establish Muskellunge Lakes. We use a special regulatory provision that we have in 97C, so that language is no longer needed. 97C081 relates to the deer raffle language, and the 97C827 commercial fishing or rough fish, that is no longer needed as well.
Okay. Any questions from the committee? Senator Saxon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Meyer, do you have anybody here from wildlife or any wildlife managers, wildlife biologists? I have a question on Section 49.
Which section, Senator?
49.
Go ahead and ask it, and we'll see what if somebody
well,
can
I just
answer.
Want to ask whoever the wildlife manager is from the DNR, I just want to ask why we'd have to raise the minimum size for muskies to 55 inches.
Mr. Chair, that is not a DNR provision. As I said, that was Senator Hoffman's bill that he added to the bill. We're working on a rule for a 50-inch slot right now with a 55-inch category on top of that. But I think Senator Hoffman has some stakeholders that would like to talk about this issue.
Well, I want to hear from wildlife, if I could, Mr. Chair.
Yep. Just identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Don Pereira. I'm Fisheries Chief for the Section of Fisheries for the Minnesota DNR.
Okay.
Earlier in the session, we've been neutral on this provision. We just wanted to inform the committee that we do have in rule right now, we expect it to pass a statewide 50-inch minimum, which will raise our statewide minimum from 48 inches to 50 inches, and we're also developing what we're referring to as a two-tiered approach. Our best information indicates that not all muskie, we have roughly about 100 lakes that we manage for muskellunge statewide. Not all of these waters can produce fish this large, so we feel that 55-inch statewide would essentially result in basically a de facto catch-and-release fishery for many of our muskellunge lakes. Those lakes that, and there's probably at least two dozen of them, that truly can produce memorable fish that are 55 inches or larger, we're going to propose moving those lakes to a 56-inch minimum, and we'll just use our special and experimental regulations rule process for doing that for these exceptional lakes.
So in rule, right now, you have inland waters being at 48 inches and Seven County Metro waters being at 40 inches. Is that correct?
That's correct. And exempted from that is the hybrid lakes or the tiger muskellunge lakes, because those fish don't get quite that large. So the tiger muskellunge waters would be exempted from this. In our current rule package, we're proposing to bring up the statewide minimum from 48 to 50. And we're not hearing opposition to that, so we're expected that rule to go uncontested. Okay. So by 2015, we should have a 50-inch statewide minimum.
This would require you to make it statewide at 55 inches, and your rule then that you're proposing at 50 inches would become null and void, right?
That's correct.
Okay. And if this were to pass, does this also mean that the metro county, the Seven County metro area would be 55 inches, or would it just be the rest of the state?
Well, I'm not sure how this would apply to our hybrid muskellunge waters, the tiger muskellunge waters.
Because I know in rule it says 48 inches except for subdivision 2B, I think it says. And in this particular one, it doesn't reference subdivision 2B, so I'm just wondering if this would refer to all the lakes then.
I'm assuming that the way that it's written, it probably would cover the tiger muskellunge waters as well in the Seven County metro area.
Senator Saxog.
Yeah, and to the testifier, so you're right now you're actively managing the muskie population. I mean, you're working on length. you're going to have a special, you're going to have a special group of lakes that are going to be 56. So I mean, this isn't something. This is something you have been actively managing. I guess that would be my way of putting it.
Senator, Mr. Chairman, that's correct. Our managers have identified somewhere in the order of 20 to 24 lakes that we feel truly are exceptional, and we'll work with our stakeholders to identify additional lakes if we feel that there are more out there. So,
okay. Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, to the witness, you talk about Taiga Muskie. You talked about two different waters. What are you referring to with those waters? And what is the characteristic in these 20 to 24 lakes that you feel gives a habitat to grow that big of muskies and other lakes do not? What's the difference, if you can answer all those questions?
Sure. Senator, Mr. Chairman, regarding the 20 lakes in the seven-county metro area, over 20 years ago, we started a program whereby we actually create hybrid muskellunge by crossing northern pike and pure strain muskellunge to create something called a tiger muskellunge. That program was started simply as an opportunity to, these fish grow pretty fast, up to about 40-plus inches. It was simply started as an opportunity for metropolitan anglers to have a greater opportunity to catch a fairly large fish in the metro region. Some of those lakes have since been converted to pure strain muskellunge as our pure strain muskellunge program has developed further to what it is today. So we've critically reviewed the tiger muskellunge program. It's always under review as to whether it's delivering reasonable benefits to urban anglers or not. So the tiger muskellunge program was something specifically created for metropolitan anglers. In regards to the second question, as far as the attributes of a lake that produced exceptionally large muskellunge, it's going to be lakes that are very productive, that have high production of desirable forage species. We know that, for example, in some lakes, muskellunge will utilize Tulibee cisco very heavily. So it's just a matter of us, and also lakes in southern Minnesota, they're very productive. They have a longer growing season. Some of those lakes have the potential to produce larger fish. Also, the density of muskellunge in these lakes, also a factor that relate to how well they grow. Mille Lacs is an exceptional lake for large muskellunge. That's one of our lowest density lakes. There's probably about one adult per 50 surface acres of water in Mille Lacs. And a lot of our prime waters, we try to manage them at densities of only one fish per 4 acres or lower. So it is definitely a low density fishery. It's definitely a trophy fishery. Exceptional large fish, and therefore we feel that a really aggressive minimum of 56 inches for those waters would probably be justified.
So, Mr. Chair, when you say forage, what kind of fish are you talking about that they eat? Is that if I'm following your management speak, that's what you're talking about, is how many baby fish or minnows or new fish? I mean, are you talking sunfish, walleye? Are you talking northerns? What are you talking as forage?
Senator, Mr. Chairman, we're talking about the primary food items that large muskellunge would eat. So it's, you know, again, in some lakes we know that they utilize tulibee very heavily. For example, they do that in Mille Lacs. In some lakes they might even suspend when they're feeding on these fish. Suckers are a common food item. They do eat other game fish, but we manage these populations at such a low density that we haven't found any evidence in intensive research statewide that indicates that introduced muskellunge caused any major changes in the fish communities and the lakes that we're introducing them into. There's probably as many game fish eaten by northern pike and other game fish as muskellunge because we manage those populations at such low densities. They're not an ecological problem.
And Mr. Chair, on the muskie, then when they grow to 48 inches, is there a typical age they are? Do they live to a certain normal age? What happens when they get this big? When do they die naturally, or does a catch and release fight, potentially shorten their lifespan if they're released in their 49-inch muskie. Can you give us a little more background on that as a committee and as the professionals?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Senator, a lot of those details, we don't have a lot of local information on that. We have garnered information from other fisheries and other muskellunge fisheries and in the Midwest. We know that the fish can grow. They can attain, you know, very large sizes in some of the popular fisheries like the St. Lawrence and the Niagara River that produce really large fish. Their rate of natural mortality at these large sizes is very low. There's a lot of details we don't know about how well they survive catch and release, but we do know that there are exceptionally large fish that are caught multiple times, indicating that they do survive reasonably well. And as you're probably aware, muskellunge anglers have come a long way in learning how to handle fish properly so they can be released with a fairly high probability of surviving after being released back into the water.
So, Mr. Chair, last question. You said a longevity. What are we talking? I mean, do they live for 150 years? Do they generally? What's a normal fish's lifespan? And what are these? What are we talking?
Senator, Mr. Chairman, that's an area that we don't have a lot of information. We do know that from fish that are actually tagged earlier in their life and caught later on, that it's not uncommon for them to live well up into their 20s and maybe pushing 30 years old. There's a lot about senescence and game fish that we basically don't know. I mean, we know that we have a lot of old walleyes and Mille Lacs right now. If they weren't fished at all, maybe they could. I doubt that. We know that sturgeon can live very, very long. We don't know if muskellunge could live to 50, 60, or 100 years old. That's kind of uncharted territory for us. I mean, we have a history in the state of, you know, going from reasonably high harvest of muskellunge back in the 30s and 40s and 50s to a system that's becoming more of a trophy-managed fishery as we move forward in time. So these populations are kind of moving into uncharted territory with our assessment history, because they're basically living longer, getting larger, and we're seeing more and more older fish in our assessments. They're very, very difficult to age, so the best way we can get information is in populations where we have tagged fish and we can recapture them later on.
I see. Thanks.
Senator Saxon.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And given the as Mr. Ferraz has gone over here, the DNR's management plan seems to be reasonable, and they can do it by rule. I would move to remove Section 49 from the bill.
Okay. Senator Hoffman, you got some people that want to testify on this, and you got a.
Mr. Chair, I do actually have a.
Before we act on Senator Saxhog's amendment, we'll take some testimony. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Yeah, before Mr. Meyer leaves, or maybe the other testifier can answer this. And I know musky fishermen are into the catch and release, and I really appreciate that. I like that a lot, and that's the sport. That's just the sport that it is, that's there. My question is if maybe you partially I talked about it with the mortality of them being released in shallow water and the possibility of a large 51, 52-inch muskie going belly up, as we call it, and not recovering, and that fisherman still not wanting to keep that fish. Does that create a wanton waste? Does that create a violation? I'm quite concerned about that large of a, and I'm sensing that's where Senator Saxhog is coming from, a very large jump from 48 to 55. Is that creating some problems out there by not taking that fish? I want a 54-inch muskie. I release a 53. Well, I have to release a 53 because right now I can't take it, and the thing goes bad. And we've had some reports of that in the lake that I live on. And I'm quite concerned about that. Does that happen a lot, or is that anything to worry about?
Senator Ingebrigtsen, Mr. Chairman, we don't feel that, that it certainly does happen. There's no doubt. Whenever we have catch and release fisheries that are mandated by statute, There's always the risk that that fish that is released does not survive. We know that it, in some years for walleye management in Mille Lacs during warm summers, it's definitely an issue. So it's not a perfect system, but these large muskel lunge are so rare that we feel that the probability of that happening is, again, it's not zero, but we think it's low enough that it's not problematic for this aspect of managing these exceptionally large fish.
Okay, Senator Hoffman.
Mr. Chair and members, I do have a couple of folks. I have a young man who caught a 57-and-a-half-inch muskie, and I want you to see this, how he's teaching us about catch and release, and I had that video. And Sean is here with the association as well, and would like to respond to that question.
How do you want to go? You want to do the video first? Do you want to do the? How do you want to do it?
Let's do the response first, and let's bring the bring our youth up here and we'll show the video.
Identify yourself for the record, and then go ahead and.
I'm Sean Kellett with Muskies Incorporated and the MMPA Muskie Pike Alliance. Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebretson. Delayed mortality, it is out there. As best as we've been able to ascertain through right now, there's currently a study in Canada going on specifically to this topic, and they're finding that the delayed mortality is typically around 2-3%. It's very, very low, and at least with musky anglers. With anglers who are not overly adept at handling the fish, it does go a little bit higher than that. But generally speaking, it's a very, very low occurrence that you do have a delayed mortality. I know I've killed a couple fish in the past. I know of three in 10 years. And those were all actually smaller fish. The larger fish tend not to get as foul hooked as a larger fish is what we typically find.
Don't admit to something you can't get yourself out of here. Okay?
Yeah. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
But yeah, typically that is not that large of an issue. And I wanted to speak a little bit to Mr. Pereira's point about some lakes having the potential to have these large fish. I respect Mr. Pereira a lot, but I do disagree with him on that point where they feel that only certain lakes are able to grow these fish to these large proportions. There's not a single pure strain musky lake in this state, aside from the Shupak strain, which is up in the northern range areas. It's a completely different strain. It's not really in the conversation that we're having here. We've seen 55-inch fish out of every single lake in this state. I've been vice president or president of Muskies Incorporated here in the metro for over a decade, and I see pictures all the time. We are able to get fish this large. And what we really want to do is we want to keep these fish in the lake. Typically, from the research that I've read, a fish can get to, in this state, can get to that 50-inch range in about, in extreme cases, 15 years, like in a Mille Lacs, where there's a very, very high forage base, and some lakes about 20 years. So if they live to 25, by protecting these fish, once they hit 50 up to 55, we're going to see a good 10 years, 5 to 10 years of enjoyment of a fish that large. That's something very special. That's where there are hundreds and thousands, and actually many thousands of people coming to this state to spend their money to catch these fish. And that's what we're really trying to protect here. We're trying to protect the experience for people. We're protecting the capital investment that we have in these fish because they're not all that cheap to stock. And we're trying to keep this place the musky mecca of the world.
You know, I respect what you had to say. I think what Senator Saxhaga is thinking is that you got to be part of the process, because for us to just make a law that we don't know if it's the right one or not is probably not something that we should be dealing with. We like passing laws, but at the same time, this sounds to me like you're an expert and they're experts and we're not experts, and we might be better off if you guys sit down at the table and figure out what the rules should be, as opposed to us just putting it in state statute and then maybe it doesn't work for a year or two or three or something. So I think that's what Senator Saxhaga is getting at here, if I'm not mistaken. But go ahead. You can respond to that if you want.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The problem with the Minnesota muskie fishery, especially in regards to regulations, is that we're always playing catch-up. And that's, and I was, I've been part of the process with the DNR since 2002, I want to say. And the biggest problem is that we're always playing catch-up with size limits. We're always playing catch-up with where the anglers are, with where the fishery is. And this is actually a forward step to trying to be aggressive with some real regulations that are going to help us out. Right now, we've seen such a boom in muskie fishing that our resource, quite frankly, can't handle it. And right now, we are not able to add additional muskie waters as at a rate that coincides with the number of muskie anglers that are entering the sport. There's over 100,000 people in the state who enjoy muskie angling, and that doesn't count the thousands that come here from out of state. We're trying to be proactive in protecting our muskie fishery. And we do know that this works. If you look at Canada, they passed 54 inches about 8-10 years ago, and there everyone was up in arms when that came along as well. Now all the resorts up there beat their chest and advertise the fact that, hey, come fish our lakes. We have a 54-inch size minimum here. You want to come here. Don't go to Minnesota. Don't go anywhere else. This is where you want to be.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, you make a good point. We're here trying to make a decision on the evidence that's brought before us, and we pay the DNR to do the science and to work for a lot more species than just the muskie. And if we just throw that out, I think that's a little counterproductive to what we have the DNR doing for ourselves or for us as a fish population or a game population for that matter. To the testifier, there's a lot of those folks out there in a couple of my lakes in Douglas County and as well as Mille Lacs that say the muskie is the reason we don't have any walleyes. And I know you'd argue that tooth and nail with the DNR. The DNR just testified that that's not true. That is not true. That's not making a big difference in the population of walleyes. So I have to respect that. But I think they also have a management plan that they're moving forward with, or they're even allowing a 56-inch muskie, which was news to me until I just heard that happen in a couple of different lakes.
Yep.
But that'd be part of their management plan. So to me, it seems like they're willing to work with folks here. A 7-inch increase in one fail swoop seems to be a long ways, but you say they're behind. They should have done this a long time ago. They should have been progressively going a little higher. Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Chair, Senator Engelbretson, yes. We should have been looking at this a long time ago. I know in your neck of the woods, there's been a lot of people coming from out of state and actually harvesting these fish in the 51, 2, 3-inch range, where it's been very detrimental to your particular fishery. Lake Miltona, for instance, has seen a dramatic amount of harvest over the last 5-6 years, where it's not the fishery it used to be. And concerning Mille Lacs, Mille Lacs for muskies peaked around 2006-07, and it's been on just circling the drain ever since. It's the muskie population there is so low that most muskie anglers don't even go there anymore. And if you look at the walleye peak and the muskie peak, they're both right around that 2006-07 time frame. And now that the muskies are going down and the walleyes are actually down now too, so it's... seems a little causal relationship to me, but
Mr. Chair, and I do agree. Miltona was a lake that was very hot topic in my area. In fact, in my other life, I think I might have even been called to a couple of meetings to try and hold some order there because they were so passionate about that. Walleye fishermen didn't want the DNR stocking Lake Miltona with muskies because they were going to eat all the walleye. Well, that's not true. It didn't happen. In fact, that's a very good fishery. And so what the DNR is doing when they do stock, that tells me that they are managing them properly, and I think we should really pay attention to that. And I don't think it's Senator Saxog's amendment here to allow them to continue it, I think, is a good idea. But 7 inches in one fail swoop just seems to be too much.
Go ahead. Just say your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, John Underhill, Minnesota Muskie and Pike Alliance. I just wanted to let you know that this is long overdue, And it is not just the two or three of us that have been talking to you guys. This is tens of thousands of muskie anglers, resorts from across the state that want this regulation to protect their financial and their resource needs. The resorts are the farmers of the lakes, and they're looking at this as a way to protect their interest. We talked about Miltona a little bit. We were talking about Big Detroit yesterday with a couple of people. They've been seeing up to 28 fish in one season removed from Big Detroit and given to taxidermists. Over 50-inch fish. That fishery up there was probably the best fishery on the planet. Big Detroit, not a huge lake, a few thousand acres, and there was people came from everywhere, and they started pulling these fish out, removing these fish. Now these guides, they're not even going there. They're not fishing that lake because they want their clients to catch bigger fish. They're traveling further, and many of them are going to Lake Vermilion. We've talked to the majority of the resorts on Lake Vermilion. They support it, from Bayview to Glenmore, White Eagle, Vermilion Dam, Whispering Winds. They all support this. I talked to thousands and thousands of people, and that is no exaggeration, over the past 3 days at the Minnesota Muskie Expo. The people want this. The anglers want this. And this is not a biological issue, as the DNR has testified. Increasing the size on these fish, you're talking about such a small population of fish. You're looking at maybe half a dozen fish over 51 inches per 1,000 acres of water that is under 15 feet deep. For over 51 inches, or for over 50 inches, you'd probably be looking at possibly 20 fish. It's a very small number of fish that we're looking to protect, but those are the absolute most valuable fish to the fishery in Minnesota, the muskie fishery. That is what people are coming here from, the Sweden, Iowa, Wisconsin. People are coming from everywhere. And they want to experience this. And these opportunities are being diminished by the day. And places like Lake St. Clair, Green Bay, they are protecting these fish because they know how valuable they are. They are going to the 54s. And they're trying to get our people that are coming here and spending their money to go other places, to go to Canada. Lake of the Woods, 54 inches. The resorts up there are advertising that as a way to draw people in. We absolutely need to protect these fish. It's not a biological issue. It is a social issue, and that's why we're here. The social side of it is the vast majority of the resorts that make their money off of muskie anglers. The associated businesses, the guides, the bait dealers that are selling 20, 24-inch suckers. Suckers as big as most of the fish that I caught through the first 30 years of my life, if I was lucky. They're selling suckers that are 20, 24 inches long, and they're getting big, big bucks for them. It's turned into a very economical friendly fishery, even during the downturn in economics. People are still showing up and wanting to spend their money on something that's as special and as rare as these fish over 50 inches. People aren't coming here to catch a 45 or a 48. If you want a 45 or a 48, you can travel to the other states that have muskies and you can catch them readily. People are coming here because they want to catch that 53, 54, 55, 57-inch fish. They're a very special fish. And I appreciate your time. And if you have any questions,
thank you, Senator Root.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. You know, if you'd have told me a week ago that I would be immersed in 55-inch muskies, I would have said, what? I mean, last week we were talking about Senator Housley getting a fishing license, and I think probably a 55 inches, probably bigger than Senator Housley.
probably true.
But I have to tell you, for the past few days, I've kind of immersed myself in this issue, really doing some really good research, and there's really good information out there about what this means to the state of Minnesota. And so I'm going to really speak for the 55-inch limit. I think it's a really good idea, especially for my neck of the woods where we have all the tourism and all the lakes. And I think it really makes sense. The folks that give us this information are folks that work with it every single day. They're folks that their passion is fishing, and they do it. And they deal with the bait. They deal with the renting the boats. They deal with the fishery. They do it all over the state. They know this issue. I will tell you that I have half of Mille Lacs Lake in my district. And so if I'm going to rely on information, I'm going to rely on information that's provided to me from people who do this all the time, and not necessarily the DNR, because I see a lake that's really struggling under that guidance. And so I would ask you to please listen to the folks that have brought you the argument for the 55-inch muskie, because it makes sense, and it makes sense for Minnesota. So I'd ask you not to support the amendment to take it out of the bill.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Rood. And, you know, you all should have got copies or 500 signatures from people all over the state of Minnesota that specifically address what Senator Rood is talking about in supporting the 55-inch, because these are people that got their feet on the ground. They're on Main Street. You're seeing cities like Walker, Minnesota, being revitalized because of the tourist industry regarding guides taking people out on leech and fishing for the big fish. Mr. Chair and members, I do have the Jacobson family here, who want to come up and show what really this is about. And I have a video that shows their 8-year-old son catching quite a big fish. So come on up, you guys.
You to go first?
Yeah, Mr. James.
Okay. Yeah, and why don't you introduce your family and everybody so we know who they are.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
My name is Eric Jacobson. This is my youngest son, Noah, who is 9. My daughter, Meredith, 13. And my son, David, 11. I'm a former resort owner from the Bemidji area. I reside currently in Garrison, Minnesota, and I'd like to say that I'm strongly in favor of this bill. I feel really strong about it. I think it's a great opportunity for the state to be proactive in the regulations to protect these big fish. Definitely want to echo Mr. Kellett's sentiments and Mr. Underhill's. A lot has been said. A lot of the things they said were things I was going to say, but just to echo what Ontario has done with Lake of the Woods with the 54-inch size limit, and even Lac Seul has been catch and release for years and years and years. And these are two of the top angling destinations in North America, and people have to drive pretty much right through Minnesota to get there. So if we could protect our fish and have a larger population of the size fish that they have, maybe they wouldn't go all the way to Canada, and they would stay here and have an economic impact on our state. I'm trying to think of the resistance that this might have to the non-muskie anglers, and I really can't think of any, because the mystique of the muskie is they're a big fish. Even a 36-incher, which we consider a small fish, is a 3-foot fish, and that's a big fish. So for them to get a little bit bigger, I don't see an impact on them, other than the fact that right now with a 48-inch size limit, if they incidentally catch a 49 or a 50-incher, they could take it home to the wall. So if we go to 55, of course, they wouldn't be able to do that. But just the fact that people still get skin mounts is so archaic. I don't understand why you have to take the fish to a taxidermist, to get a mount, when you can get a replica made. You let the fish go, get a graphite replica of it. It's beautiful. It lasts forever. I got my first one 19 years ago, and it looks as good today as it did then. And I'll promise you, a 19-year-old skin mount, you know, they're going to shrink and fade. And so I don't really understand that part of it. But I just think it would be an overall good thing, and I'm missing what the pushback is would be from non-muskie anglers. I appreciate your time, Mr. Chairman. Any
Thank
questions?
Thank you. Do your kids want to say anything?
Like to say something?
Mm-hmm. Caught the fish.
Just say your name first, though, okay?
I'm Meredith Jacobson.
Okay, go ahead.
From Garrison. I love the thrill that comes with, like, catching the muskies. And then, like, catching any muskie is really fun, but, like, the bigger it gets, the funner it gets. So, like, I just think that if they could get bigger, then it would be even more fun to catch. So I'm for it.
So who's going to catch the fish on this video? Oh, so you caught it. Okay. And how big is that one?
54 and a half inches.
54 and a half. Okay. So you'd have to, did you throw it back?
Yeah.
Okay, good girl. All right. So you want to play a video here, Senator Hoffman? Because we got, yeah. Yeah.
You're a guide, right?
I was a guide up on Bemidji. Yeah.
And where are we at? And look for the subtitles because really the message here is.
This is on Mille Lacs. This is on November 1st, 2010. You'll see it. Okay. Yeah, if we had some audio, the. Okay. Yeah, the fishing rod on the right side of the screen as you look at it is, has got the bite now and the fish hit. David's reeling in the second line. And now I'm getting him set up with the fish to reel it in or to attempt to reel it in. You never know if you're going to land them.
He's holding on.
His personal best prior to this is 47, so he keeps hoping it's bigger. And I said, yes, this is much bigger than your 47. So I was telling him to keep the line tight while I went and got the net.
Oh, yeah. Oh, big, giant mushroom.
Giant one.
Is there a speaker?
Oh, yep, lift.
Whoa! It's pretty frantic.
It's bigger than 47.
Yeah. I gotta get up front. Is it gonna turn?
Do it!
Real. Real. There you go.
Now the drag got backed up somehow.
Real.
So he's reeling, but no line is coming.
Reeling?
Down.
Yeah. It's not reeling!
It's not reeling.
Oh. They tightened up the drag for him. Yeah.
Oh. Hold on. Okay, when it comes off onto the boat, I'm going to net it, okay? You take it. Ready? Lift.
Come on, take some onto the boat here.
There you go.
There
it is.
Real. I watch back by the stern light here.
Guy running the net.
Going around. Over there now.
Chewed up. Well, I've run the net many times and got chewed up.
Okay, here you go, bud.
You like to add more than one buck, you know.
But you can't.
Oh,
that's
a big one.
You did it!
I broke it!
Oh my god.
Here's the punch.
chip removal on the fish. Can I get you a dog, buddy?
Okay, so
who's doing
okay,
the
you ready?
Yeah.
She's lively. Wow, she is super lively. All right, buddy, here comes. Arms up. This is what I want you to do right here.
Oh, sorry.
Right there. Get straight up in there, right there. Got it?
Take a picture.
Okay, tilt her back a little, sure, like that. Okay, you got it?
Sure, yeah.
I'm trying. Ow, I'm trying. Here we go.
You want to ow, and
hey,
look at her smile.
No.
Yeah.
One more.
I'm ready.
Here's a moment of truth.
Oh, yeah. God, they can get you.
In the fish
tail.
Oh,
Dad, you don't want to kill it. No. I want it to grow bigger. I don't want anybody to kill it.
I want it to grow bigger. I don't want anyone to kill it.
57 by 27. Is it all in there?
Yep.
You're the man, David. Here she goes.
Here she goes.
I think she wants to go bad, too. We've had her in the net.
This time,
it's revived. 57 inches.
Wow. She's beautiful.
She is beautiful.
Aw, this just feels great.
Isn't it?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Right after you caught a huge muskie.
Oh, my gosh.
I keep it on her.
Yeah. Oh,
I
yeah.
Got her.
Good power. Oh, goodbye, baby.
I got her perfectly.
Woo! David, give me 5. What did you do?
I don't know. Awesome!
You did a fabulous job, Dave.
I don't know how I did it, though. I did it.
Congratulations. Give me 5. Give me a handshake. Yeah! That's my boy. 8 years old. Sweet. So, let's call Grandpa and Mom.
Yeah.
Who did the filming?
Thank you. Thank you for showing that.
Who did the filming?
That was a stationary camera on a pole in the front of the boat.
Okay,
all right. And then when I was handling the fish, David was.
So how much is a 57 incher weigh?
That we calculated at 52 pounds.
52 pounds.
So it was about 2 pounds shy of the state record, 54 pounds.
All right, I'm getting them. I hate to do this, but I'm getting a message that some of us are on the finance committee at exactly the same time as we're in this committee here. And the suggestion is that we recess to go deal with some issues over in finance. And do you have any more testimony on this? Because maybe we can deal with this.
I do. I mean, for interest of time. But, Mr. Chair, let me just clarify one thing. The last time we did a slot increase, it was at 8 inches that we did the slot increase. So this is actually less than the last time we did it. So.
All right. You say you have more testimony because I may have to just recess here before we act on it.
And that's fine. We can come back to that because there's also 2 amendments there. You have Senator Herz and Senator Saxhogs that needed to be added to the complete bill too.
All right. Chair, I have a couple amendments too.
Okay. All right. Then we'll recess to the call of the chair, and it'll be as soon as we get done over in finance here because there's about 4 of us on this committee that have to go over to finance. So I apologize for that, but this is what happens this time of year in the legislative session. So.
Of legislative business is fluid.
We call the meeting back to order. No, I'm not done in the other room yet. So what we're going to do is, since we have members flying all over the place here, is we're going to lay the game and fish bill over until Wednesday. And then in the meantime, all the people that are here for bonding proposals, we're going to start doing the bonding proposals as soon as we can get some members in the room that can present their bills. And do they know who they are and where they are? The people who are authors of the bills? Like Cronin or Weber. Weber's here. So Senator Weber could do his bill. And in the meantime, I'm sure the word will get out around that people are getting ready to do bonding proposals. So I'm going to run back over to the other room, and Senator Herr is going to chair, and then we'll hear these bonds. What we're going to do with the bonding proposals is we'll lay them over after the presentation for a recommendation to the bonding committee for inclusion in the bonding bill. So, but it's important that we get a presentation and we get everything on record. So with that, I'll turn this over to Senator Herr, and he'll chair the committee while we're doing this other committee over in 121, 123.
Thank you.
Senator Weber, well, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My pleasure today to testify on behalf of Senate File Number 2770. This is concerning water and wastewater improvements necessary in the city of Curry, and approximately the amount of approximately $2 million. This bill, this request was handed to me late in the process. We did get it, obviously, dropped in time and met committee deadline. In the meantime, they have begun the process of contacting rural development and the PFA for the necessary steps they need to go through there. At this point in time, I have with me today Vice Mayor Gene Short from Curry, as well as Steve Robinson, their consulting engineer. And at this point, I will turn it over to Vice Mayor Short for his presentation.
Okay. Thank you, Senator, and thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Gene Short. I serve on City Council in Curry, Minnesota, and pleased that the committee is hearing our request today. The City of Curry is seeking finance for the replacement of our sanitary sewer and water treatment facilities. The estimated project cost is $1.98 million. We've had numerous amount of problems with our water and sewer over the past few years, especially in the wintertime with all the water main breaks. Some of our infrastructure dates back close to 100 years old. Curry is a small community of 232 people. We do have two outstanding USDA loans for a total of about $465,000 that we are paying off. Because of the size of our community, it's rather difficult to ask the residents to pay more money to take care of this project. We appreciate the senator's assistance and cooperation on this, and this time, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to Steve Robinson from Short, Elliott, and Hendrickson, no relation to myself, just in case, but Steve Robinson, Mr. Chair, and members.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Mayor. Anyone in the committee have any questions for Mr. Mayor at this time? Okay, Mr. Robinson, please introduce yourself.
Thank you. Steve Robinson with Short, Elliott, Hendrickson in our Worthington office. Began working with the City of Curry 2 years ago identifying some infrastructure improvements that were necessary. They have a quite dated and old collection system in their sewer. Our plan is to replace approximately 4,000 linear feet of sewer main that would connect to 33 existing services. The existing sewer main, they have a high incidence of INI inflow and infiltration. A lot of clean water is getting into the sewer system. There are some areas of the city that are not currently served by the sewer, and there are some sewer lines that run outside of the public right-of-way that cut across private property. In addition to the sanitary sewer collection, we are looking at replacing a number of existing water mains or extending water mains to unserved areas. They have some areas that are served by extremely small water mains that are, in one case, there's quite a large area that's served by a 3/4-inch diameter water main. Minimum state code is a 6-inch diameter. There are some areas that don't have water mains, and with the undersized water mains and the frequency of breaks that they have a high incident or a high cause of concern for disinfectant safety and also for fire flow safety. And as Mr. Short stated earlier, with the small population in the city and their existing debt of $465,000, we're looking to pursue funding options for the city.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Robinson. And any comment from committee member or question? Okay, Mr. Weber, any Any last comment?
Mr. Chair, thank you again for allowing us to testify today, and we look forward to this being laid over for inclusion into the bonding bill.
Yes. So Senate file, this is almost as easy as the Land Subcommittee. Senate file 2770 will be laid over for recommendation to the Capital Investment Committee for possible inclusion in the omnibus bonding bill.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Committee members.
Okay.
And Coonan, Senator Coonan? Is Senator Coonan in the room? Senator Coonan, welcome. And
no questions on this.
Feel free to introduce your guest.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thanks for hearing Senate File 2864. What this is a appropriation from bond proceeds, $5,800,000 for scientific and natural area acquisition, and then also $8 million in appropriation from bond proceeds for Native Prairie Bank easement acquisition. And the scientific natural areas protect rare resources which may not exist elsewhere in the state. The goal is to ensure that no single rare feature is lost from any region of the state for Minnesota's natural heritage, including landforms, fossil remains, plant and animal communities, rare and endangered species, and geological formations. These bonding dollars would fund acquisitions of 1,000 acres of SNAs and conservation of areas of biodiversity significance, including native fen, forest, wetlands, savanna, prairie and rock outcrop communities and their rare plants and animals. The Native Prairie Bank easement is a volunteer program between interested landowners and the DNR in which the landowner agrees to manage the land in ways that protect the native prairie. The easement leaves ownership in the hands of property owners who may continue to enjoy it, manage it as part of their working farm, sell it, or pass it down to their heirs. Less than 2% of native prairie remains in Minnesota. It's North America's most endangered habitat type. Prairie is an important tool to improve water quality, help with groundwater recharge, flood mitigation, and provide important habitat for grassland birds, pollinators, and other wildlife. These bonding dollars would fund acquisition of conservation easements on 3,780 acres of native prairie through the Native Prairie Bank program and manage assistance on 500 acres of native prairie bank lands. And Mr. Chairman, with me today are Mr. Steve Chaplin and Ms. Peggy Booth.
Okay. Mr. Chaplin, welcome. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Steve Chaplin. I'm a senior conservation scientist with the Nature Conservancy, but I'm also a member of the Prairie Plan Working Group. This is the group that in 2010 developed the Minnesota Prairie Conservation Plan that has now been adopted by 10 leading conservation agencies and organizations. I'm also the leader of the Glacial Lakes Local Prairie Plan Implementation Team that's charged with implementing the Prairie Plan in an important prairie core area in Pope and Candy, Yohai counties, part of Senator Coonan's and Senator Westrom's districts. Now, the reason I bring up these two other positions that I have is that the Prairie Plan calls for the protection of all remaining native prairie in the state. That means there's about 105,000 acres that are native prairie that's still unprotected in Minnesota, and the Prairie Plan suggests that it should be done with about 70% of easements and by 30% with fee title. So The Native Prairie Bank and SNA programs are expected to play a critical role in meeting the goals of the Prairie Plan, and it's for this reason that I'm here to speak today. But first, some background. Native Prairie, as Senator Coonan mentioned, is grassland that has never been plowed but still retains most of its native plant species that are expected from that site. It's also the local representative of temperate grasslands. And, you know, as was mentioned before, temperate grasslands are the globe's most endangered, least protected habitat type in the world. And so that even more than tropical rainforests, prairies and other types of temperate grasslands are very rare from a worldwide standpoint. In fact, here in Minnesota, only about 1.3% of our original 18 million acres of prairie has survived. And the rest, of course, is now, for the most part, cropland, which some of the richest soils in the world, which is thanks to that being developed underneath those prairie situations. First, I want to speak about the Native Prairie Bank program. This is a permanent conservation easement program that buys land from willing sellers, or buys easements from willing sellers, that buys the right to plow or develop the land. The land stays in private hands and on the tax rolls, and the landowners can retain the right to hay and graze that native prairie. The Scientific and Natural Area Program, the other program we're talking about here, is Minnesota's Natural Areas Program. Land is purchased from willing sellers to protect the best examples of each natural community in the state. And this is important because these are the reservoirs of biological diversity for reintroduction of local genotypes. They are an important benchmark for scientific research. They're important as outdoor classrooms for environmental education. And finally, important as high-quality areas for wildlife watching and enjoyment. Now, although the SNAs are open to public hunting, they are managed primarily to maintain and enhance the biological significance of the natural community and rare species that are found there. So because the Native Prairie Bank and Scientific and Natural Area programs are critical to meet the goals of the Prairie Plan, and that both the Native Prairie Bank and SNA programs have traditionally been supported by bonding, these are the reasons that the Nature Conservancy supports Senate File 2864 to include $5.8 million for the SNA program and $8 million for the Native Prairie Bank in this year's capital investment bill.
Okay. Thank you, Mrs. Chaplin. And Senator Coonan, this flyer is for the presentation, right?
Yes, that's right, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. It just says Senate File 2964 instead of 2864. Okay. All right, Ms. Peggy Booth.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Peggy Booth, and I supervise the DNR's Scientific and Natural Area Program, which includes the Scientific and Natural Areas, our state natural areas, as Steve referred to them, as well as the Native Prairie Bank Program. We have two handouts that I'm going to be referring to, and they should say Senate File 2864, which is what we're speaking to. There's a typo on those. So as Steve indicated, the first section of the bill is for $5.8 million to acquire scientific natural areas and to do related development to assure that their quality and public use continues. The scientific and natural areas are part of the outdoor recreation system, and they really protect natural resources that don't exist in other parts of the state's outdoor recreation system and that may not exist anywhere else in the state. We currently have 159 scientific and natural areas that protect about 189,000 acres. A majority of those acres are our peatland SNAs, which were also established by statute. As part of the outdoor recreation system, SNAs really are for people to use. They are open 24/7, and people are very much encouraged to do all kinds of nature-based outdoor recreational activities on them. 89% of the acres of SNAs are open to public hunting, and it would be our intention to evaluate the best combination of uses for any lands that are acquired through this appropriation, including potentially hunting, fishing, and trapping. If you look at the back of the handout on the SNAs, it shows some a preliminary map from our SNA strategic plan, which is under development. And what we are doing is using GIS systems and other evaluation systems to pinpoint where we're going to get most bang for the buck in establishing new scientific and natural areas. So the areas in the underlying red, yellow, green portion of this map, the areas that are the red and oranges, give us the highest potential to protect all the biological diversity of that particular part of the state if we were to acquire lands in those areas. And then overlaid on top of that, initially sort of pink, but you can get a sense of some blobs on top of that, are what we're calling conservation opportunity areas. And so we will be working with our partners, such as the Nature Conservancy, to do more proactive outreach and working with the Prairie Plan implementation teams to try to focus a lot of our acquisition activities in that area. I just want to give you a couple examples. In the far southeastern part of the state, there's a property owner who's we've been talking to who has lands that contain springs that feed into the Root River, which is important for fishing. It also includes bluff prairies and forested areas, plus a unique geological feature that supports rare species called algific talus slopes. Another example, on the far western edge of the state in Yellow Medicine County, we have right now a SNA called Mound Springs Prairie SNA. It's about 600 acres. It's open for hunting and trapping. It has jackrabbits, and it has some rare species on it. But there is a private land holding in the middle of it, and we would like the opportunity to be able to work with that landowner to buy that property. Speaking about the native prairie banks, you should have two things in front of you. Another two-sided colored handout and our native prairie bank brochure that we give to landowners. The Midwest is experiencing the highest rate of grassland to cropland conversion since the 1920s. And 75% of the remaining native prairie in the state is owned by private landowners. Therefore, our work with private landowners, really a partnership that we work with those largely farmers, grazers, and other private landowners, is the key to the Native Prairie Bank program. We want to have the lands protected in order to protect the rare species and the wildlife habitat they support, but we still want those lands to contribute to the local economy. So when we acquire a native prairie bank conservation easement, we negotiate the terms of those easements with the particular landowner so that the landowner can do grazing, seed harvest, haying, or other activities that are important for his operation, his or her operation, and for the local economy. What we pay for Native Prairie Bank is set forth in statute, and it's 65% of the marginal agricultural land rate as established by Bowser. And I do need to say that the figures that Senator Conan said in terms of what we could acquire with $8 million is actually slightly less because those agricultural land prices are going up so fast. Currently, we have enrolled 113 native prairie banks that cover over 9,000 acres. The map that is on the back of this handout, the little red spots on it show the locations of native prairie bank across the state. They're very scattered and very impacted by other uses in the area. And superimposed on this are the prairie core areas and the corridors that come out of the Minnesota Prairie Conservation Plan. We are working with the local technical teams and other groups such as Pheasants Forever and the Nature Conservancy to figure out the best ways to protect lands within those prairie plan and prairie core areas. Just a couple examples that I want to give you. And before I do that, I want to mention that we have a waiting list of Native Prairie landowners that would represent 75 projects protecting over 6,000 acres. So the amount that we might get through the bonding will definitely help through that. A couple examples of projects we're doing in the Prairie Core area. In Lake Benton, in Lincoln County, there's a landowner we're working with on a track that immediately adjoins the 4,300-acre Hole in the Mountain area that has both Nature Conservancy lands and wildlife management areas. Another example, in Redwood County, we're working with a landowner adjoining the Cedar Rock WMA to be able to enroll over 150 acres. And both of these are properties that will have grazing, and by having a native prairie bank, we can work carefully with the landowners to assure that the grazing doesn't impact the rare species and helps those prairie lands thrive. So with that, I thank you for this opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Ms. Pegge. Any, Senator Dietze?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Booth. We spoke earlier. I have some questions. So LCCMR, so in 2011, we gave money, LCCMR gave money to do the strategic plan. And so some of that has to do with, I think you took the biological surveys and then we're mapping stuff out.
Mm-hmm.
So are there surveys not just done here, or you guys just haven't finished entering
them? Yeah.
And are you using that to fill up the rest of the state?
Yeah.
Ms. Booth.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Dietzick. The way that these prioritizations are done is all of the Minnesota Biological Survey information for that particular subsection, including the final maps showing where different native plant communities are, needs to be done. And this north central portion of the state is the last portion of the state where the Biological Survey is doing their data. So we do not have complete data there. So that's why that is white. Over the next few years, we hope to complete that area as well.
Senator Dietze.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we gave, the LCCMR gave them money in 2012 or 2013 to finish that. So that should be coming. And then in 2013, because of PILT payments, I know the LCCMR gave money to do some renovation of some SNAs, but we had the whole PILT discussion, so we did not give money for acquisition. I know in this year we have about $2.5 million in the LCCMR for SNAs, and some of that is, you know, could be for PILT. How does the $2.5 million from LCCMR and then the money here, how do these projects, is it just, you know, you've got this long list, and so it's literally this much you can do from LCCMR and this much you can do from bonding, and you're just kind of checking off that checklist and working your way down?
Yeah. Mr. Chair and Senator, how you described it is the way it works. The acquisition list that we submitted with that LCMR proposal is for about 10 times the dollar amount that LCMR will provide. So we will use what funding we have and continue to buy the highest priorities first. And certainly the need exceeds what we can get from either LCMR or the Outdoor Heritage Council.
Senator Dietze.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your patience here. I'm checking off my questions. And then I know you mentioned these are part of the outdoor recreation areas or the recreation areas. I know I've heard from some people where there is discussion, and if you go to the website, it talks about recreational uses of SNAs, and there is continued discussion about some say opening them up, but I just want to confirm that it is. There's not motorized vehicles on here because scientific natural areas, there are a lot of plants and special unique plants, and so we don't want people trampling over them. So when you talk about having these public hearings and opening up and more recreational uses, it is more just kind of hunting, fishing, and maybe allowing canoes and stuff, or can you explain that?
Yeah. Mr. Chair and Senator Dietzick, rules that govern SNAs say that there are certain kinds of activities that can't be allowed on SNAs. That includes camping, motorized uses, horses, dogs, hunting, and so forth, unless we have an exception made in the designation order which establishes the SNA. And statute says in order to make that change, we have to have public hearings. So this month and next, we are having a series of 10 hearings to consider allowing additional uses at SNAs. So those types of uses are typically hunting, fishing. It may be access by watercraft. It may be dogs on leash or under control. In one case, it's likely to also be swimming. So we are going through this systematic process to allow non-motorized uses that are appropriate with the particular resources of the SNA.
Thank you. How many? Yes.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, this is my last question. And now we're getting, so I have a question on the Native Prairie Bank easement acquisition. We've had discussions in this committee in the past on easements. And so how are these easements monitored and enforced? And then how is that monitoring and enforcement program funded?
Okay.
Ms. Pat.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dietzick, that's a very, very good question. The DNR takes its responsibilities for stewardship of easements very seriously, which does include landowner relations, monitoring, and enforcement. We do have guidelines that call for us to do monitoring of our Native Prairie Bank easements every 3 years, and to date we haven't had a major enforcement issue. The short answer is we do that when we get money appropriated, which we can use that money to do that kind of work. So we have been getting some LCCMR appropriations that allow us to do that, and we have had discussions with funding for Native Prairie about, say, with Outdoor Heritage Funds, putting it into a interest-bearing account such as the Forest for the Future program does. But so far, we do not have that authority. So we are really having to use LCMR, Heritage Enhancement, or General Fund as we go to do those kinds of stewardship activities.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Dietzick and Ms. Peggy Booth. Any question or comment from other community members? Okay. Well, that was a good question from Senator Dietzick, and then we will move on and lay over Senate File 2864 for recommendation to the Capital Investment Committee for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Bonding Bill. Thank you, Senator Conan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You've been here a lot this year.
Yes, I have, Mr. Chairman.
How much are you spending so far this year?
I'll let you know after your final decisions are made, Mr. Chairman.
Is this Senate File 1781?
Senate File 1781.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is an appropriation from bond proceeds to the Public Facilities Authority for a grant to Clarus City to design and improve and reconstruct a local road and to 9-ton capacity with curb gutter and to replace or extend existing water main, sanitary, and storm sewers. And this is to a business park on the south edge of Clarus City. I have with me today the city administrator, Mr. Wendy Block, and he will give you an update on the project and let you know the importance of this project to Clarus City.
Okay, now, Mr. Black, we don't have a lot of time, so your first name sounds like you may like to talk a lot or something. I'm not sure,
right on.
Oh, go ahead. Go ahead and go through. Go ahead
with your members, Wendy Block, City Administrator for the City of Clear City. And thank you for the opportunity, and I will make it brief and a shorter fish story than the rest of the day. As you see from the description, it is basically the growth of an industrial park for and business park for the City of Clear City. I'll skip over the numbers and begin with a little history back in 2012 when the city worked very hard to gain natural gas services through an agency called Dooley's Natural Gas. That impacted not only Clear City, but several smaller communities in the area. And so Clear City, by the fact that it took these actions, have really benefited the cities of Raymond, Maynard, Prinsburg, and a large rural area, particularly some large farm producers in the area. It's working with Dooley's Natural Gas that have kind of helped us evolve this need for an industrial park to the south. And as you can see the numbers, let's skip to the first drawing or the first map so that you get a sense of where this is. It's at the south end of the town, and it is bordered by the Hawk Creek, which, as you can see, meanders through the community. And then if you turn to the next page, you'll see what the exact developments are. And the city has already taken steps to put in some of the sewer and water as we could afford last year. But essentially, because we are involved in some heavy rehabilitation of other existing storm water and sanitary sewer within the city, because we're investing in building a 24-unit assisted living facility for the people of Clear City and surrounding area, we essentially are to a point where we're not going to be able to borrow additional dollars. And without this money, this development will not happen in the very near future. And we believe that we are sitting on an opportunity, in particular with the development of natural gas in Clear City, that the city has never seen before. And it has given us the opportunity to weigh and consider developing new businesses that needed natural gas as a basic service. So as you can see, the benefiting results at the bottom of the page, we believe, not only do we open up immediately an 18-acre area for prime buildable and accessibility for businesses to develop, we'll have $3 million plus of immediate development from such companies as Dooley's Natural Gas. We're opening a gateway to an additional 40 to 50 acres that sits immediately to the east of this property. We know that we'll have 8 to 10 jobs created for the citizens by the businesses that build within the next year or year and a half. And the end result is that Clear City really becomes the hub of the rural area that's trying to develop. We appreciate the help and the support we get from places like Wilmer and Montevideo. But there is a culture unto the rural area by itself. And we need to do what we can to support that growth of these rural areas. And Clear City is the leader in that respect. So we thank you for your attention to this project and your consideration of it.
Thank you very much. Any comments or questions? Mr. Knopf, this one's really prescriptive. Do we generally write them this prescriptive, or can we loosen this up a little bit so they can use the money for more things than just what's said here? Well,
Mr. Chair, we do try to be somewhat prescriptive on bonding appropriations, especially for local grants. You could have it for public improvements of a capital nature or something to that effect, but I guess
you can know what you want to use it for, though, right?
Correct.
Yeah, so, okay. All right. I was going to try and let you use it for more things than what you just had on here. So. All right. Okay. Senator Cornyn, any other comments?
No. Mr. Chairman, as you can see, or as you've heard from Mr. Block, that this is important to Clear City, and there's a lot of potential activity that could be happening here in this small community with the natural gas that has been brought in. Was it 2 years ago now? And so this would really be a good boost for the city of Clear City. Thank you.
Okay. All right. And seeing no more comments or questions, we'll lay Senate File 1781 over for possible inclusion and a recommendation to the bonding committee. Okay? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Because they're a city.
But it's 415. What? That rules is 415.
Did they change it? Well, that would be plenty of time.
Well, here's the deal. You talk with Senator Dames, and if he's okay with you going first, you can go first, okay?
All right.
Okay.
We're on that.
So then, Mr. Chair, then Senator Dames has the hook.
I get Senator Dames up there.
Senator Fischbach, welcome to the committee. Senate File 2650.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you very much. And Senator Dames, thank you very much, too. And I do apologize. I mean, it's been a crazy day, and I've got one more committee I've got to make it to today. But well, I do have.
If I would have known we were going to have Cold Spring here, we would have held this meeting in the morning so they could have brought some bakery. Don't
These aren't bakery. These are beer. These are beer folks.
The same beer.
So maybe we should have it in the evening.
No. And they didn't bring, I bet you they didn't bring beer either, did they?
But, Mr. Chair, the length of the time, they probably could have brought rolls and beer.
they probably drank it while they were waiting for us to reconvene. Okay.
But, Mr. Chair, I have folks with me from the city who can much better explain what's going on. I mean, obviously, the bill, if everybody's looked at it, it provides $8 million in bonding for the construction and siting of a new water treatment plant. So, and I think that Paul Hetland, the city administrator, Mr. Chair, could probably give a better explanation.
So will the new wells be used for making the beer then?
Mr. Chair, yes. Actually, that would be exactly what we'd be getting into.
Okay. Go ahead. Who's up first? Say your name for the record and then,
yes.
And then just do your testimony. Okay.
Paul Hetland. I'm the city administrator of Cold Spring. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for hearing us. On behalf of the Cold Spring City Council and the mayor, again, we thank you for your attention. This bill basically is a result of working with, we have a small trout stream that goes through the center of the city that has a population of brook trout in it. Population, a little over 90 was the last count about a couple years ago. And in a 2010 law that was passed, there can be zero impact to trout streams in a given area. So the basically the cone of influence, as it's described, that water is drawn out of the ground. There can be no influence at all on the springs that feed that trout stream. And actually, Cold Spring itself was named after that trout stream. It was a once upon a time called Cold Springs, and we dropped the S for whatever reason. Probably because we got too drunk or too filled up on donuts, one of the two. And anyway, sugar high, right. With that in mind, we had started a very long process in the last few years of trying to figure out how we would move forward on supplying water. Because basically, again, working very closely with the DNR, this hasn't been us against the DNR, but working closely with them to be able to figure out water needs that the Cold Spring Brewery needs to operate its facility, as well as Golden Plump within the city, as well as our Ricori school system, retirement facilities, everybody's water needs. We needed to figure out a source and a source quickly. We were not able to go anywhere basically north of the city because that's where the aquifer feeds the spring itself, so we needed to look closer or outside of there. We also have nitrate issues surrounding the city, so you start to look at ag and other residential needs that basically affect the aquifer. We had to look further out still. So with the proposal that's before you, actually what you should have in your packets is really around $8.3 million to be able to service the need itself. Looking at what we've put into the pot for skin in the game, we've already put in $116,000 from our resources in trying to solve this issue. And our annual budget for our water needs, because this isn't taxpayer money we use, we have to use an enterprise fund with water, is about $400,000. So about a fourth of our entire budget we've used already to address these needs. So it's certainly a major commitment on our part. In addition, this proposal would build a water treatment facility that would be a major cost, an annual cost for us and every user in the city, including the brewery, Golden Plum, and every household. So we feel that of kind of the investment from the two sides of the table, state and the city, it would be a good proposal that from protecting the strong resource that exists there from the state's end of it to help with the bonding, to help put in that infrastructure, as well as the city's end of it, that we have ad infinitum the cost for annual operations of water treatment. So with that, I've actually brought, I mean, because really this bill touches all three of the major areas that this committee is charged with, agriculture, environment, and economic development. I've asked an individual named Bill Kemp from the St. Cloud Area Economic Development Authority to join us. He's not on the agenda, Mr. Chair, but if you could please allow him to speak. He has a few statements to make on the impact of the economy for our given area.
Before we go to Mr. Kemp, Mr. Hetland, you said something about $8.3 million. Did you want to change the number in the bill from $8 million to $8.3? Is that what you, Senator Fischbach? I don't know. Is that because we can request more if you want here.
No, Mr. Chair, you're very generous.
Well, I don't know if the number is the number you want. If you want a bigger number, I mean, we can just amend the number to 8.3.
No, Mr. Chair and members, I mean, I guess it's usually a matter of Mr. Heshen, Paul Heshen, my public works director, and I, we're used to kind of the common sense level of, you know, like we got to put some skin in the pot. So we recognize that we know that we got to fund something, but we know that's going to be that's not a made up cost what you have before you. $8 million was a guess before. So if you want to include 8.3, we would love to include that.
No, it's up to you. I know Senator Fischbach wants to request the amount that you need, and if $8,300,000 is the number, we can just amend this $8 million to $8,300,000.
It has.
Okay. Mr. Chair,
yes,
with an extensive discussion, we just decided to stay with the eight because honestly, what Mr. Hetland had mentioned earlier, there was 160 that's already been spent, and that would be part of this. So I think that the $8 million makes sense at this point.
Okay. All right. Well, who wants to go next now? Just say your name for the record, and then just go ahead.
Thank you. My name is Bill Kemp, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm a business development director for the Greater St. Cloud Development Corporation. We're an economic development corporation whose mission is to lead the economic development in the Greater St. Cloud community and support the communities that make up our region. Basically consists of Stearns, Benton, and Sherburn counties. We became interested in the Cold Spring Brewing Company and the city of Cold Spring issues when it appeared the issues the city of Cold Spring were facing would have an economic impact on the region as it would affect expansion plans and jobs for various businesses. The Cold Spring Brewing Company, as you have heard, has been around and coexisted with the Trout Stream since 1874. It is a very large employer in Cold Spring and has survived as an employer for a very long time. Their percentage of tax capacity, total tax capacity of the city, is over 10%, which is greater than Mayo or Hormel's percentage in their respective communities. We understand and support the need to protect our natural resource and are sensitive to areas like the trout stream, like trout streams, but it comes with a cost, and we think the state should be a participant in assisting Cold Spring to protect those areas. Whatever the brewing company is going to do is going to be severely affected because their cost of water is going to skyrocket, and they can't even use the water they have to pay for. They have to untreat it to use it for beer. But it also affects the entire city of Cold Spring because the new treatment facilities will mean higher water rates just to operate the facility. Other employers in town are going to be affected with their expansion plans, if any, like Golden Plump, And, of course, the school and nursing homes are large employers in the city as well. We just think that the state should be involved with the solution to this problem that's being created by trying to protect the trout stream. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kemp. Senator Fischbacher, maybe Mr. Hetland, I see this is a request to the Public Facilities Authority. So have you made an application already, and do you know if you're on their list? Or
Mr. Hetland? Mr. Chair, members, certainly we have. Unfortunately, our median household income is too high to be able to get any type of grant funding out of the PFA. We can apply for straight-out loans. We're also not eligible for USDA dollars either because of our larger household income in that regard. So it's a very good question.
Okay. And who wants to go next? You want to say something, or are you sure. Just...
Yeah. Yes, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Paul Hessian. I'm the Public Works Director for the City of Cold Spring. Thank you for letting me speak. I will try to make sure you don't regret it. I just want to take 2 or 3 minutes so everybody can better understand our predicament. I've been working for the City of Cold Spring since 1991, manager since 1995, public works director since 2002. So in all this time, I've seen a lot of change. We lost City Wells 1 and 2 due to nitrate contamination, so we built 3 other wells. We built 2 new water towers. We built 2 new wastewater lift stations, did a total rehabilitation of an old wastewater lift station, a $7 million wastewater plant expansion and rehab of a 1963 facility, and we're still paying for that. We still have another 10 years of payments on that one. And now this water expense is really overwhelming. We've been increasing our water and sewer rates over the years to try to prepare for this. We've raised sewer rates the past 3 years in a row, and it's projected for the next 2 also. We've made several water fee increases in the last few years. I don't know the percentage of the water, but in the wastewater is just a 28% increase in the fees just over 5 years. So then you look at all the wastewater plant expansion expenses we still have, half of that $7 million, and all this, it really, really is overwhelming.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you for making the trip, and thanks for your patience today. Anybody have any questions? Okay, Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifiers, I was just kind of wondering, related to the nitrate contamination, has there been any change in any of the upstream ag practices to reduce the nitrate contamination so that you don't contaminate any new wells?
I could address that if you want.
Motion.
Okay.
Thank you.
We've been working with the local farmers. The Department of Ag and Soil and Water Conservation District have been helping us a lot, and they have really proven that the farmers are not over-fertilizing. They can't really afford to. You determine how much nitrogen you need, and you put on only what they need. The rest is a financial waste. But still, there is impact. Corn, for instance, is a very leaky crop. It's not going to capture all the nitrogen. Some of it is going to seep down between the roots and get into the water system. And so we have even been helping the farmers pay for nitrogen inhibitors to help keep that nitrogen in the root zone. So we're working together with the farmers. We think they're doing a good job and just doing whatever we can to stop any further nitrate contamination.
Okay. Any other comments or questions? Okay. Oh, Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, briefly, you mentioned the law that was changed in 2010. Is that the only reason you're needing to do your wells?
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, yes.
So are you the only city affected by this, or one of the few, or what is wrong with your system otherwise but for the law?
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, we're unclear, uncertain of the ramifications to other areas of the state. In our meetings that we've had with DNR officials, they have stated that there's been similar situations across the state but weren't specific, but also that they didn't want to see a repeal or change of the law from their vantage point to protect the resource, because we had certainly mentioned that as a possibility.
And Mr. Chair, I will add, Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, I will add that there are several other bills that we include that I introduced, that Representative Jeff Howe and myself introduced, and we were looking at several paths. And one of those paths was to look at the law itself, because as Mr. Hetland mentioned, the DNR said this is just kind of the beginning as they begin to enforce this law. And what had happened, I think, was initially, and maybe some of the other folks that are here, but initially I think what the original kind of instigator of the whole thing was a water permit, a pumping permit that kind of started it off, and then it went downhill from there. So, yeah, right now it is a huge issue for us.
So, Senator Fischbach, is there a possibility to get an exemption from that law or an extension? Dual-track ideas, but...
And Senator Tomasoni, Senator Westrom, it would have to be legislative.
Right.
And as of right now, any of the other kind of policy legislation we introduced has not been given a hearing.
Okay.
So this is kind of, Mr. Chair, this is kind of one of our paths that we've been trying to go down.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
All right.
Thank you.
There.
No, I was just going to say, Mr. Chair,
or?
I was going to say
okay.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Waving goodbye.
I'll salute instead.
Mr. Chair, bye-bye.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Fischbach. We'll lay over Senate File 2650 for possible inclusion in a recommendation of the Bonding Committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dames, you've been very patient.
Yeah. Huh?
You go ahead, whichever one you want.
Thank you.
2682, I take it?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for allowing us to present Senate File 2682. Senate File 2682 is a request for an appropriation of $1,190,000. To be for a grant for the city to the city of Dawson to design and construct a publicly owned infrastructure for an industrial park. And today I have two testifiers with me. I have Crystal Hansel, the city manager for Dawson, and also Barry Blinky, who's an engineer with Boatman Mink.
Who wants to go first?
First.
Go ahead. Just say your name for the record and then go ahead and test.
Okay. My name is Crystal Hansenel. I am the city manager for the community of Dawson. I just want to say, firstly, thank you for your time in letting us come talk about our project. The city of Dawson has a 105-acre industrial park. The east side has 65 acres and the west side has 40 acres. Currently, this is the only industrial site in our county of Lac La Parle. In 2007, we had one business on the west side, and since then, we have gained two more businesses, as well as just very recently, right next to the site, we have gained another business who came to us all the way from the east coast. The site also has available rail access to businesses who come to our site, as well as the county recently did a fiber optic broadband project. So
you're piquing my interest now. What's the business from the East Coast?
All the businesses that we have are agricultural related.
Yeah. Okay.
And we also have a countywide fiber optic broadband project that was done, so we are able to offer not only the rail line as well as exceptional technology to new businesses coming in. We do have a lot of interest in the site. Recently, we did have a data center who wanted to come to the site. Unfortunately, we do not have the basic infrastructure in place. The city did apply for a federal EDA grant, and we were awarded a little over $1.1 million for that. Unfortunately, because we are a small rural community, a project of this size is not feasible for us unless we receive more funding, including the federal grant, which we did receive. I apologize. I want to mention that with the federal EDA's timeline with this grant, if we do not, we would need funding this year. Otherwise, unfortunately, we would not be able to move forward with the project. Okay. And at this time, I would like to turn it over to Barry Glinkley.
Barry Glinke. He's our project engineer with Bolton & Mink.
Mr. Glinke, just say your name for the record.
Barry Glinke, Bolton & Mink Engineers. I think all of you have a nice, pretty picture in your packet there as well, kind of illustrating what is going on there in the industrial park there for the city of Dawson. You'll see on the left there, there's about 12 acres of land that is currently not served with roads or city sewer and water. That's the existing industrial park that is filled up. So we need to put some more utilities in to open up at least those 12 acres. And then on the other side of the county road, on the east side, we have about 40 acres over there that we can open up for development as well. Crystal mentioned 65 acres over there, but you can see on the drawing there we've got some water resources issues over there that we have to work around as we develop land. So that's the difference between the 40.3 acres and the 65 that Crystal had mentioned earlier.
And members, I want to point out that this is pretty classy. They put all our names on the proposal.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's kind of neat. You don't see people doing that.
Chair, and I don't even think I spelled any of them wrong.
So. You got my initial right.
And we have a saying, you know, when it's in color, it's a done deal, too, you know. So. Oh. Yeah, don't you know that?
You know
that, Senator Ingebretson.
Chair, and what was the federal matching dollar, or the federal dollars? Maybe I missed that.
Chair, Senator Ingebretson, the feds right now are at 1.1895, so just under the 1190. That's their.
And
half.
Do you only get it if you have matching funds? Is that what I heard you say, or do you
yes.
already have it and you can't spend it until you get matching funds?
You would need the matching funds to move forward to get the grant. Yes.
So they'll give it to you if you get matching funds. Is that
yes.
what you're saying?
Okay.
Go ahead, Senator Ingebretson.
There's a timeline on there, though. You said.
Yeah,
federal?
Chair, yes, there is a timeline on there. We have to be in the ground early part of next year to capitalize that. I'll back up two for you. That federal amount is 50% of the total project cost. So we have that federal 50%. We're trying to fill in the gaps for the other 50% to make the project happen.
Okay. All right. Anybody else? Any questions or comments? Senator Dames, any final comments?
Well, I'd just like to thank the committee and thank yourself, Mr. Chair. I think, as you heard here, it's an opportunity in Lacaparra County out in western Minnesota for some development, and also in rural Minnesota. We're always looking at ways that we can attract new businesses, and this would be an opportunity with the fact that they have the railroad broadband and things like that. It's a good location for this industrial park, and it's sorely needed out in that part of the state, so we'd appreciate your help on this.
Okay, thank you. And once again, to your witnesses, I'm sorry about the glitch today. Should have had you back home by now, but I apologize. So
that's okay. We just appreciate your time.
Okay, thank you very much. So we'll lay over Senate File 2682 for recommendation to the bonding committee. Thank you so much. Okay, Senator Dames, Senate File 1935.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We appreciate the opportunity to present Senate File 1935. Senate File 1935 is a request for $150,000 from bond proceeds for a grant to the City of Seaforth to design, construct, and equip improvements to the municipal water system, wastewater system. And today, as a testifier, I have with me Pam Sharon, and Pam is the city clerk of Seaforth.
Welcome, Ms. Sharon. Just say your name for the record, please.
Pam Sharon, clerk for the city of Seaforth.
And go ahead.
Seaforth installed a new wastewater system in 2010. After it was completed, deficiencies in engineering and contract and construction were found. In 2013, a lawsuit against the engineering contractor was filed. And in January of this year, through mediation, a settlement agreement was reached where the contractor will do a portion of the fixes. But in order for the full system to be corrected, that cost is approximately $600,000. Rural Development has tentatively committed to 75% of that cost, or $450,000. leaving a shortfall of $150,000. And due to the size of our town and the current user rates, it's just not financially affordable for us to, excuse me, for any additional loans at this time, which is why we applied for the bonding bill.
And I see this is to the Public Facilities Authority also. So are they aware of the project?
Yes.
And are you on their list, or
yes.
is that a loan? Is that a loan or a grant that you're applying for? A grant, I would assume.
Yes, for a grant.
Okay. All right. Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I'm looking at this right, you have about 85 people in the population?
Correct.
But it is a small town. In the settlement agreement, how much did you have to pay for the court case or anything, or was that all?
It was settled through mediation.
But you initially had to file some stuff to sue them to get it going?
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to follow up on that. I think there's 40 homes, approximately 40 homes in the city of Seaforth. So if they had to pay this themselves, that'd be about $3,750 a home. Yeah, and they're stretched pretty hard as it stands, so this would be pretty tough to have that type of a charge put on their tax rolls.
Senator Saxley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But Ms. Sharon, we've all, I think, around this table who have rural, who our districts are in rural areas have kind of run into the same thing you have. You know, whether I'm talking about McGrath or
McKinley.
Or Effie, or, you know, they're all about 80 people, and yeah, it's
small town.
The sewer, there's a group of engineers that went through and didn't do a particularly good job designing, a lot of these, and so they all kind of croaked at the same time, and it's a problem.
So, Ms. Sharon, Senator Dames, do you know the history behind the name of Seaforth, how they got the name Seaforth?
I would have to turn that over to my testifier. I don't know.
Mr. Chairman, no, I don't know that.
Okay, we would like a little email in the next few days with a little
history. I will do that.
Here. Okay, all right. Okay. Okay, anybody else have any questions? Okay, all right. Then we'll lay over Senate File 1935 for inclusion and recommendation to the Bonding Committee. Thank you so much for
coming.
Thank
you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay,
members.
Thanks for your patience, members. Too. I appreciate it. Who's next? Senator Saxon?
Right.
Unless you want to let Senator Rood go first, up to you.
No.
I guess not.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Senator Rood.
I did get a text from Senator Housley, and she said she is indeed bigger than a 55-inch
I got the same text. I got the same text, and she said she already bought the fishing license.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, would it have been more appropriate to say that the fish was larger than Representative Kahn?
No.
That would have been more accurate.
We probably would have got in trouble on that one, too. Senator Saxhog.
About the, Mr. Chair, about the same size as the late Mickey Rooney.
There you go. He just died today, didn't he? Or yesterday.
Yesterday or whatever, yeah.
Okay, so, Senate File
2518, Mr. Chair and members, is what we're presenting today. The bill appropriates money to the DNR for Minnesota Forest for the Future. The money appropriated will come from the Bond Proceeds Fund. With me today is Amber Ellering. How'd I do? Ellering. There, that's better. Forest analyst for the DNR to describe the Forest for the Future program and answer any questions that you might have.
Ms. Ellering, just say your name for the record, please.
Thank you. That is, thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Amber Ellering. I work for DNR Division of Forestry, and I do not manage the Minnesota Forest for the Future program, but I'm here to provide an overview of the program and answer any questions you may have. The Minnesota Forest for the Future program is the overarching program for identifying and protecting private working forests in Minnesota using conservation easements and fee title acquisition. The long-term target for the program is to protect approximately 530,000 acres of forest. Okay. To date, the program has accomplished over two-thirds of its goal from a variety of fund sources. However, the remaining needs for protection are significant and they are immediate. DNR has identified many thousands of acres as priorities for acquisition under this program. In particular, our current priorities include a project you may be familiar with to protect forests associated with the Pineland Sands Aquifer in west central Minnesota from conversion to irrigated agriculture, as well as a project to reduce inholdings within state forests and provide access for management and public recreational use. There are several other projects throughout the state working with industrial private forest landowners to avoid parcelization and fragmentation in areas targeted for divestiture. The Pineland Sands Aquifer Protection Project is an immediate need and a good example of what this program is designed to do. It is a multi-year project with multiple funding sources. It will protect a significant drinking water source for many communities in west central Minnesota, including Park Rapids, Minnesota, and the forest benefits associated with keeping that land in forest condition. In that part of the state, over 7,500 acres of private industry-owned forest has been sold over the past few years to potato growers, resulting in loss of access to adjacent forest, loss of wildlife habitat, recreation, decreased timber production, and risks to water quality. We are seeking to reverse that trend and to work on our other priorities for that program. And with that, I'll take any questions.
So, Mr. Chair, I would reiterate what Ms. Ellering was talking about in terms of our goal with Forest for the Future, which has been going now for almost 10 years, I think, was when we started it. Fragmentation, that meaning if you have a large forest and start selling little pieces of it, it soon becomes fragmented. It's not as good for managing timber, and it's not as good for wildlife, and ultimately it'll destroy your forest, and parcelization is just the opposite of that, of course. So we think that we mentioned a couple of the examples here, but we think that this has done a pretty good job of keeping our forests healthy and sustainable, and consequently, we think it's important. It's by the way, Forest for the Future is endorsed by the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association.
Yeah. Okay. Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm wondering, is this type of a project, and maybe I missed it in your testimony, is this eligible for the outdoor heritage funding as well, or have you tried that and not been able to obtain that?
Senator, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. We currently have, in the past, received upwards of $40 million from Outdoor Heritage Fund for projects within this program. We have about $1 million in the current bill, if it is passed as in its current form, for the Pineland Sands Aquifer Protection Project specifically. However, the need vastly exceeds the available funding we can get from that source. We're looking at about 7,000 acres of need in that region, and that would cost about $14 million. We also are seeking funding through the Environment and Natural Resource Trust Fund via LCCMR, and that is a current proposal. Therefore, it may be appearing in a bill next session. And that is a $2 million request.
Was planned and part of.
Senator Ingebrigts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Ellering, you mentioned the potato producer projects. There were two potato producers that purchased property up in that region. Can you talk a little bit more about that, or who they are, or how that happened, or were those lands that were forested before they were actually purchased, or can you tell me how that happened?
Ms. Ellering, did you hear that?
Senator, I don't know who the purchasers of the land are. I do know they were private industrial forest intermixed with county and state forest lands in the Bedora and Huntersville state forests. I can't tell you about the purchasers, though.
I think that, Senator and Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, I think that if you look at the three top potato producers in North Dakota, you'll probably come up with one of the person that purchased it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm somewhat familiar with one of those producers because he's certainly has a lot of does a lot of production in my new district. But I'm wondering, when you talk about fragmentation, we certainly should be concerned about whether they're taking a chunk out of the middle or whether they're taking a chunk on the edge of the forest. Do you know if these projects were on the edge of the forest or how did that become a potato ground out in the middle of the forest? It didn't, did it, or was it an adjacent to the open, already being produced land? Or productive land, I should say.
Senator, I believe, I'm not sure exactly the degree to which the lands are intermixed within the existing state forest, but I think it has to do a lot with the trend of the increase in the price and value of agricultural lands and that becoming economically viable. We're concerned about any forest that is converted to agriculture, especially in that part of the state, and overlaying an aquifer.
Mr. Chair, excuse me, did that answer your question, Senator Ingebrigtsen?
You and I can talk later. Senator.
Okay.
Thank you.
Got to be a lot of forests that were converted to agriculture, though, I would believe.
But one of the real victories, Mr. Chair, Senator Scalzi brought up the idea of the Lesard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council, Ms. Ellering talked about $40 million. Well, about $25 million of that went to the to Blandon Conservation Easement, which was 187,000 acres that was put under easement, and it was one of the real victories for avoiding fragmentation.
Senator Sacksack, Mr. Knopf's got the real number. What was it?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think Senator Sacksack, it was closer to $34 million. I seem to remember $17 million each year, or $32 to $34 million.
Yeah, but there was, Mr. Chair and Mr. Knopf, but there was some money that wasn't Lesard Sam's there, too.
But, Mr. Chair, that was an addition. I seem to remember the total somewhere around 30. It's been a few years.
Yeah, I know.
For both of us.
Well, you're probably right. In which case, that was even a larger percentage of in that particular grant.
Little asterisk here, then. Nobody knows who's exactly right, but somebody's in the ballpark here. So yeah. Just for the record. Okay. Any other comments or questions? Okay. Seeing none, then Senator Sacksack, thank you. We'll lay over Senate File 2518 for inclusion and recommendation to the Bonding Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
While Senator Root is going up to the table, Senator Westrom has an unusual request that I'm going to honor today just because of the interruption that we had during the committee hearing when we were doing the fish and game bill. You have a witness that wants to give you some testimony on an amendment that you're going to have on Wednesday.
Mr. Chair, if you would indulge us just briefly.
If it's okay, Senator Root.
Done.
I just want to boot it again. I figure as long as the committee members are still here, I better have them do this because otherwise, when you get done, they'll all get up and walk out.
Mr. Chair, I would just ask Don Peter Meyer to come. I think I got his last name right. He represents Freeport Family Fishing, and the amendment I have is an A7 amendment that I was going to offer to the Game and Fish, and then with it suspended now and coming Wednesday, he's had to drive in a long ways, and I just wanted.
That's why I figured we'd accommodate you on
testimony.
This. I'm sorry you had to wait so long, and I apologize for what went on here.
That's
so.
Fine.
Okay.
I'll just tee it up real quick, Mr. Chair.
Tell us what the amendment would be.
What's that?
Tell us what the amendment would be.
What the amendment would do, Mr. Chair, is just. It would direct the DNR to offer a fishing pier permit for a lake that they've been trying to get a pier on. They have private funds raised, and the group and the JCs ready and able to put this pier in for families. And I'll let Don just briefly talk about it quickly to the committee, and then if there's any questions they can ask, and I'll bring it up Wednesday when the bill comes back.
Okay. Don, just say your name for the record, okay?
Yeah, Chairman, members. I'm Don Petermeyer. I'm the president of a small nonprofit at Freeport. We promote kids fishing and recruitment of and the retention of older fishermen. We've run a kids fishing tournament. We give the kids fishing equipment from donated money, and we've stocked walleyes, probably close to 100,000 fingerlings in local lakes. We have a lake cleanup. We have roadside cleanup and other projects. We've accumulated quite a bit of funds, and we would like to put a fishing pier in on a lake called Long Lake, which is near Freeport. And that pier we would figure would be used by a lot of elderly people that no longer own a boat, and it'd be used by, we'll say, single mothers or fathers with that don't have a boat and want to take their kids fishing. But the DNR has told us that Marine Corps owns the proprietary rights to the pier, and for that reason, we can't build one. That's at least their main reason they give us.
And so your amendment, Senator West.
Right, this would all be totally free to the taxpayer. We have the money.
So you would build another pier up? Go ahead, Senator.
Mr. Chair, what this would do is just direct the DNR to issue a permit that they would then build a pier to the similar specs as what the DNR has put in lakes, but they would do it with private dollars that they've raised already, and that's the issue. Apparently, the DNR is telling them at this point they have to do it all through Marine Corps or not get a permit, and they've got the private funds to do this to similar specs, and that's the negotiation that's just stalled out and not going anywhere. And they've got the funds raised and local community ready and anxious for this, and that's the impetus behind the amendment. It was a bill I had introduced last year, and it hasn't.
Does anybody in the committee want to ask Mr. Petermeyer any questions while he's here? Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering why it's not possible to work with Marine Corps and work together with your funds to build the pier.
Well, we could donate the funds to the DNR to get to Marine Corps. But first of all, we can build it for almost half what Marine Corps can. So we'd have to come up with a lot more funds to get the pier. And second of all, if the local community found out we donated the money to the DNR, the DNR is not universally loved in our area, so we probably couldn't count on a lot of donations after that. And may I add that we attempted a few years ago to build a pier on another lake, and we went through quite a hassle. You might have read about it in St. Cloud Times, Outdoor News, and it was on a couple radio stations, our battle with the DNR at that time. Well, finally, the DNR did put one in at taxpayers' expense. So we have that pier in, but this is at a different lake. And we still have the money, may I add, and we'd like to use it. We've been building this fund for this purpose. And it just seems to me, if I had my way, I would like to see any organization in the state be able to do this. It wouldn't have to be Marine Corps' design. Get some other private design, because from what I understand, there's many other organizations that have attempted to do this too and were just flatly told no. In fact, I was told that, you know, that most of the other organizations, when they explain it to them, they understand. So I guess I'm the only one that don't understand why we can't benefit the public free of charge to the taxpayer.
Okay. Any other comments or questions for Mr. Petermeyer? Okay. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Senator Rood, Senate File 2281.
Mr. Chairman and committee, I did have my mayor and vice mayor of Pequot Lakes with me, but they had to return home for their own council meeting, so you're stuck with me. I did ask them what was the most important thing that I needed to remind them of, and I busily wrote this down. And our vice mayor said, please don't change the slot limit on sewer bass. So there you go.
That should be worth $250,000.
Senate File 2281 appropriates $250,000 in bond proceeds to the Commissioner of Employment and Economic Development for a grant for the City of Pequot to replace the spray irrigation field equipment at the city's wastewater treatment facility. Many of you have been up to Pequot Lakes, and they're currently, well, they've been doing this for a while, but it's really within the last month, it's really the process has sped up, and we're going to be moving the road. If you come up this summer, you'll see in Nisswa, that road's almost done, the four-lane right through Nisswa, and now we're working on the four-lane that will go through Pequot Lakes and all the way up to Bemidji Center. So it's a project we've been working on for a very long time, and now we're getting closer. And as we're getting closer, the road realignment will go through part of the city's spray field. They do spray irrigation in Pequot Lakes. And so when we do this upgrade, you'll see on the map a segment goes through the city's wastewater irrigation field. And so what this is for is to help them buy, I believe they need three spray heads.
Goes right through.
And the city will need to contribute half, and that's the $250,000. And so they're a small city, again, not quite as small as the last city that we had, but they just need some help in moving that spray field as we go forward. And there is a resolution in your packet from the city. With that, I'll stand for questions.
Okay. Any questions? Senator Rood. Okay. This is in PFA, is it? Right. Yeah, okay. All right, then, Senator Rood, since you don't have any testifiers and we don't have any questions, I guess we'll just lay this over.
Easy squeezy.
Yes. Maybe we should dispense with testifiers from now on. Who knows? No, I'm just kidding. All right. Okay, so we'll lay over Senate File 2281 for inclusion and recommendation of the Bonding Committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee.
And with that, that's the last one, right?
Rock bass.
So what do we have a time for Wednesday? Or because we'll be in session, or what are we going to be doing here? Do we know? We don't know that yet. All right. So, what do we meet before session or after session?
I'm writing down for him.
I suppose we'll find that out. Anyway, Wednesday we'll be bringing up the game and fish bill, and I'm pretty sure that's going to be the only bill, right? Or do you have more?
Possibly not.
the pot's not getting any bigger, is it? No. All right. Thank you. Meeting adjourned. It's really bypassed.